Well, it's interesting to see how many of you remember your high school chemistry class where you had to balance equations, because these equations do not balance. But there's a reason why they don't balance. And actually, they really do balance if you look at it in the right way. But let me set this up. Well, this class is called paradoxes, right? So. But we are done with the creation psalms. It only took us, what, a year and a half to get through all the creation psalms? Maybe a little longer? So now we're speeding through the book of Proverbs. Going to spend some time on Proverbs 8, which is one of the three accounts outside of Genesis that parallels the events of the six creation days. You know, it's Genesis 1 that people in the church really fight over, but there's really no need for the fight if you actually integrate Genesis 1 with Psalm 104, with Proverbs 8, and Job 37, 38, and 39. But before we jump into Proverbs 8, there's a passage in Proverbs 3. Proverbs 3, verse 18, 19, and 20. By wisdom the Lord laid the earth's foundations. By understanding he set the heavens in place. By his knowledge the deeps were divided, and the clouds let drop their dew. Remember last week we kind of finished up with what's the blessing of ice ages and why we need ice ages and just how great it is that we have ice ages and just how unique the current ice age is that we're living in. There's never been an ice age like the one we're living in right now where we get this very long spring where literally the temperature of the earth sits 3 degrees centigrade below the maximum and has been sitting there now for 9,000 years. Never happened before, as we know, in the history of the earth. Certainly hasn't happened in the last 40 million years. But what I want to share today is how ice ages got started. The very first ice age of any significance, well, there's actually one at 2.9 billion years ago. It came and went. And then there were three major ice ages, followed by what's called a slush ball event. And that happened at 2.45 billion years ago. And ever since then, we've had regular ice ages. And so what was it going to kick this in? Well, the interesting thing is that to get ice ages, you're going to need life and you're going to need plate tectonics. But there's a synergistic relationship between life and plate tectonics. You can't have life lasting for any significant period of time without plate tectonics, and plate tectonics can't last for any significant period of time without life. That's one reason astrobiologists are persuaded that Earth is probably the only body in the universe that has long-lasting plate tectonics. Because unless you've got long-lasting life, you can't sustain the plate tectonics. But if you don't have long-lasting plate tectonics, you can't sustain the life. The two work together. Now, what the plate tectonics does is it recycles nutrients. And without the recycling of nutrients, you can't sustain life for a long period of time on planet Earth. And it's life that hastens the erosion of continental material into the oceans. And by the way, long before there were continents, there was life in the oceans that was eroding material at the bottom of the oceans into deeper basins. And it's that erosion that's critical for sustaining plate tectonics, and especially for sustaining plate tectonics in a way that won't be catastrophic to life. And the very first life forms on planet Earth were what they would call anoxic photosynthetic bacteria. You say, what is that? That's bacteria that can thrive where there's virtually no oxygen in the environment. Now, those same bacteria die when they're exposed to a lot of oxygen. Now, those kinds of bacteria exist on the face of the Earth today, but they only exist in deep ocean basins where they're cut off from the oxygen that's dissolved in the ocean. I mean, there's a reason why fish tend to swim around on the surface, because that's where most of the oxygen is in the water. The dissolved oxygen gets less and less as you go to deeper and deeper water. And you go to deep enough water, that's where today you'll find these life forms. Now, interestingly, there is a paper published just a few weeks ago making the point that as they study these anoxic bacteria that exist at the bottom of our oceans, they don't see any difference between those bacteria and the bacteria that existed 3.8 billion years ago. And there's actually two papers that I've got in my briefcase that make the point that when you look at these bacteria, we see no evolution. For 3.8 billion years, they're the same. So this is disturbing to the Darwinian paradigm, because you'd expect there would be some evolution, but we don't see any. And their explanation is, well, their metabolic rate isn't very high, and therefore they're not going to evolve at a rapid rate. But 3.8 billion years is a long time not to see anything. And moreover, our metabolic rates, yes, are about higher, anywhere from 15 to 20 times higher, but only gives you a factor of 15 or 20. So that is a new challenge to the Darwinian paradigm that's just showing up in the scientific literature. Yes?
Wouldn't an evolutionist just say some things evolve and some don't?
Well, what they would say, and this actually goes back to Darwin's Origin of Species, that where the environment, the physical environment, is static, you'll see no evolution. And it actually takes change in the environment to get evolution. But the environment for these anoxic bacteria has changed dramatically and repeatedly over the past 3.8 billion years. Now, the evolutionists would say, well, some of those bacteria evolved into the advanced life. But of course, they're saying that without any real evidence. But the whole point is there are evolutionary biologists that are observing this paradox. Now, when we look at ancient bacteria and present-day bacteria, they look the same. Anyway, back to the bacteria. Now, let me actually set this up for you a little bit, and we will start. Remember we talked about this last week? How there's this aggressive growth of minerals that takes place from the formation of the solar system in giant molecular clouds, and where you get these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon meteorites that come together and stick, and then you actually get a bunch more minerals, up to 60 minerals from 12, and then you get a new kind of meteorite that actually pushes it up to 250. And so at the time of the formation of life, you're getting upwards of 250 minerals. But once you have the origin of life, and once you've got life in this synergistic relationship with plate tectonic activity, notice that the number of minerals goes up by a factor of 6. Now, 1,500 minerals will be fine for bacteria. It's not fine for animals. Animals need a lot more minerals, and especially us humans, if we want civilization. And this is where the ice ages come in. A combination of biology and ice ages, and especially what's called the great oxidation event, is responsible for pushing our planet up to 4,300 minerals. And didn't really get to talk about that last week, and actually this fits into the context we're talking about in Proverbs chapter 3. But here's a conundrum for the history of life on planet Earth. The sun's brightness changes over the history of the Earth. And when the sun is forming, it's accumulating mass, and the mass of a star, pardon me, the brightness of a star, goes up with a fourth power of its brightness, which means if you double the mass of a star, it becomes 16 times brighter. And therefore, when the sun is accumulating mass, notice its brightness jumps up. In fact, the sun at one time was twice as bright as it is today. But then it began to lose mass. All young stars lose mass. And so during the sun's youth, it lost a lot of mass and hit a minimum somewhere around 83 to 85% of its present brightness. And then it begins to gradually brighten. Now, what causes it to gradually brighten is that somewhere around here, nuclear fusion kicks in. And this is really what's providing most of the light coming out of the sun. And that nuclear fusion is taking hydrogen and fusing it to make helium. And if you remember anything from your high school physics class, when you take four hydrogen atoms and turn it into helium, the helium is not as massive as the four hydrogen atoms. And so because of E equals mc squared, that missing mass gets converted into energy. And that's really what is responsible for all the heat that comes out of the sun. It really comes from the transfer of hydrogen into helium, and the loss of mass, E equals mc squared, is what keeps the sun shining as brightly as it does. However, as the sun continues to burn and burn, yes?
I'm confused. You're saying that the sun was brighter before nuclear fusion happened?
Well, okay. For example, Jupiter is not doing anything nuclear.
Right.
However, big bodies will actually gravitationally collapse over their history. And so as a planet or a star shrinks in size, it will radiate energy. So, for example, Jupiter is about 3 degrees centigrade warmer than it would otherwise be, just because of the fact that it's radiating energy through gravitational shrinkage. Now, this would have been the case with the sun. As it's accumulating more and more mass, it's actually shrinking in size, and therefore, even before nuclear fusion kicks in, you get a lot of light. But that can't be sustained for very long. I mean, a famous British physicist, and at the turn of the century, calculated that the sun could not stay bright through gravitational radiation any more than 33 million years. So there was a time when people thought, well, the solar system's got to be younger than 30 million years because the sun can't burn that long. But then 1895, they discovered radioactivity and realized, you know, they first discovered fission, then they discovered fusion, and realize, hey, if we've got nuclear physics going on, the sun can actually burn for billions of years. However, as it's burning for billions of years, it's accumulating more and more helium in its core. And it's the core of the sun where it's actually all this nuclear fusion is taking place. The surface of the sun, about 5,800 degrees. That's Kelvin. But the center of the sun, 17 billion. So the center of the sun's a lot hotter than the surface. And why is it so hot at the center? Well, it's because of all the pressure of gravity heating up the center of the sun, and that's what ignites nuclear fusion. When it hits 17 billion degrees, that will ignite nuclear fusion. Then that stops the star from shrinking. The reason why our star's diameter remains constant is you've got gravity trying to make the sun smaller, but then you got the nuclear furnace pumping out energy that's trying to make the star bigger. And because those two are in balance, the sun's diameter stays the same. Okay. The sun, however, will get bigger. The reason why, and it actually has been getting bigger at a very slow rate. In fact, if we wait long enough, it becomes big enough to engulf the Earth. But that's quite a ways off into the future. So you're worried it's a little more than 4 billion years from now. That will happen, all 4.5 billion years. But what this graph is showing is that as this nuclear furnace continues to convert more and more hydrogen to helium, that helium weighs more. It's got more mass. And so what this happens is that the ratio of hydrogen to helium, the helium ratio goes up, the amount of helium goes up compared to hydrogen. That increases the density of the core of the sun. And as the density increases, that stimulates the rate of nuclear fusion. And so over the past 3.5 billion years, the sun has been getting progressively brighter and brighter. I mean, this is the global warming thing we can't walk away from. You might be able to fix what's going on in the atmosphere of the Earth and you know what human activity is doing, but no matter what you do, the sun is going to get brighter. And fortunately, it brightens at a very slow rate. So you're not going to notice that it's any warmer tomorrow as a result of this process on the sun than it is today. You literally got to wait a few million years before you notice a significant difference. Yes?
Can we do another writing campaign that you could go on Dennis Prager and talk about this as a scientist, global warming, because there's so much now. I mean, you're a racist if you don't believe in global warming today, you know, like Jenny.
Well, it's crazy because, yeah, I think it'd be good to get this on Dennis Prager because it's become politicized.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I've written about in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, there is a way to take the politics out. The way you take the politics out is find solutions to global warming that have no economic impact. In fact, I recommend you find ones that actually boost the economy. If you do that, everybody's going to vote for it. If you take the politics out, people will do the right thing. And we should have learned that lesson from Prohibition. You can't pass a law that people don't want to obey. And, you know, we may all want to obey it here in the United States of America, but what about China and India and Russia? And unless the entire world cooperates, it's not going to work. Kind of what happened in Prohibition. If we all agree we don't like alcohol, the law is going to work. But what happened during Prohibition is the majority of the population said, we want our beer and wine. And so they couldn't enforce it. And likewise, people are going to want to drive their automobiles. They're going to want to have a high standard of living. No one wants to vote for a law where we have to, you know, go back to the Stone Age type of, well, that's a bit of an exaggeration. But I mean, there actually are people in the global warming movement that want to take cars away from all citizens and get them to ride bikes and buses. And I don't think you can enforce that. People love their cars. And they don't really like riding bikes 30 miles a day. Some do, but not everybody. Anyway, you'll see it all in Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. There are multiple solutions we can pursue that would actually boost the economy at the same time. And by the way, the message of Job is, the thing you want to focus on are the rainfall patterns. If you take care of that, you'll take care of the climate issue. And actually, we should be grateful that we've had 9 billion years of stable climate. We take that for granted. And if we actually look at these ice core results, we realize that that simply hasn't happened before. By the grace of God and by His intervention, we've had 9,000 years of optimal stable climate. To think that we can sustain that forever is simply ignoring the physics of the solar system. It's you know, at best we might be able to extend that stability for a few more decades, but no, you can't extend that to forever. Ice ages are inevitable, and as I mentioned last week, ice ages are good for you. We should be thanking God for ice ages.
Right.
So, but let me get back to the original ice age. Here's the problem. How do you keep the planet warm enough for life when the sun is this dim? And, you know, life was existing from about here forward. So you've got this long period of time in which the planet is being warmed by a rather dim sun. And all you need to do is change the luminosity of the sun by 1 or 2% and the planet goes sterile. So how do you explain the fact that life was abundant 3.8 billion years ago, 3.5 billion years ago, and life is abundant today? All right. The solution was planet Earth back then had a lot more greenhouse gases in it than it does today. I mean, that's kind of what's driving the global warming thing, right? We're pumping too many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. It's nothing compared to the greenhouse gases we had way back when. Now, people have tried to come up with carbon dioxide models in order to keep the planet warm enough for life at 3 to 3.8 billion years ago. Carbon dioxide is too weak of a greenhouse gas. I mean, even if you made it 100 times more abundant than it is today, it still will not be able to keep the planet warm enough under those solar conditions. And so the only other greenhouse gas that we can find that will be powerful enough in order to warm the surface of the planet in the context of this fainter sun is methane. Now, our best models tell us we need a combination of lots of water vapor, lots of carbon dioxide, and lots of methane in the atmosphere. So back in that era, previous to 2.5 billion years ago, our atmosphere had way more water vapor, carbon dioxide, and methane. And we're talking by anywhere from tens to hundreds of times as much as we have today. So, for example, the methane quantity in the atmosphere was about 60 to 70 times greater than it is today. Now, the only way you're going to get methane in the atmosphere is through little creatures called methanogens. Methanogens are bacteria that feed on minerals and produce methane as a waste product. So if you've got lots of methanogens, it will pump enough methane into the atmosphere in order to keep the planet warm enough for life. So you can thank God for all those methanogens, because without all those methanogens, we couldn't have had an origin of life as early as 3.83 billion years ago. You would have had to wait until about 2 billion years ago. But if you wait until 2 billion years ago, there's no way you can chemically transform the planet fast enough to get human beings on the face of the Earth before the sun gets too bright. Now, if you keep looking at this curve here, it's going to go up, and it's going to go up at a faster and faster rate as we move into the future. Now, you say, how much time do we have before human life will be forced into extinction? Well, chemists estimate it's probably on the order of 10 million years. Because what's going to happen within 10 million years, the sun will get so bright that in order to keep life bearable on the planet, in other words, cool enough that human beings can walk outside without having an air-conditioned suit, like the astronauts use when they're on the moon, which would make life a little impractical. I mean, if you look at those astronauts on the sun's side of the moon, they're walking around when it's about 250 degrees out there, and so they have to wear this suit that has an air conditioner inside of it. But guess how much the suit weighs? They have a very lightweight suit that they've invented. The first ones they came up with were over 400 pounds. They've now reduced it to 250 pounds. But, I mean, it's just not practical for all of us to walk outside this room with a 250-pound suit on. There's only, I think, a few individuals in this class that could walk very far with that kind of a suit. I think it'd be a challenge for most of us just to get to our car with that kind of a suit. Yes.
I take it the cows have taken over in comparison to the methanogens at this point.
We still have methanogens on the face of the Earth, but they only exist under what are called anoxic ocean conditions, or deep underground. And the problem with methanogens in planet Earth today is that they can't tolerate oxygen. Oxygen exposure kills them within hours or days. And so they can only live in those habitats on the face of the Earth today where the oxygen content, and by the way, the oxygen content in order for methanogens to be able to survive is about 1/100,000th of the oxygen level in the atmosphere in the oceans today. So yeah, I mean, oxygen levels today are 100,000 times too high for these creatures to exist. But back at this point, there was oxygen in the Earth's environment. Enough oxygen, as I've explained, to stop any naturalistic pathway for the origin of life. Because for a naturalistic pathway for the origin of life, you can't have any oxygen at all. Even 1/10,000th, or pardon me, even 1/1,000,000th or 1/10,000,000th of the oxygen we have today would stop prebiotic chemistry. But during this time, up until what's called the Great Oxidation Event, which occurred at 2.45 billion years ago, the oxygen level in the oceans and the atmosphere was 1/1,000th of a percent of what it is today. Today it's at 21%. So divide that by 100,000 times. That's the maximum these methanogens can tolerate. And when it gets above that, they start dying off. Now, in order to keep the planet warm enough, therefore, it's crucial that the oxygen content be kept under 1/100,000th of where it is today. But we actually have sulfur isotope measurements that tell us that throughout this epoch, oxygen never got above 1/100,000th of the level that it is today. There was a question in the back. Yes.
I don't know if I understood correctly when you were teaching this once about fracking and how if you go too deep the methane escapes, then would that die or wouldn't that? I thought you said that that could, you know, really ruin. And the second question is, if they are fracking today, are they aware of this and are they making sure they don't hit those spots or whatever?
Well, yeah, I don't think it's a worry because where they are doing fracking are places where you do not have methane hydrate deposits. The methane hydrate deposits, you say, what's methane hydrate? It's basically methane and water frozen together. In fact, what's interesting, you can get a block of methane hydrate ice and you can light a match to it and it'll burn. kind of cute watching this block of ice burning.
Haven't they talked about using that as an energy source?
Oh, well, the greatest fuel source on the planet today is methane hydrates. I mean, some people argue there could be as much as 100,000 times as much methane hydrate in the crust and the oceans of the Earth as there is of all the coal, oil, and natural gas combined. I mean, there's a, by the way, if you get the book Navigating Genesis, I tabulate all the biodeposit resources that exist on the planet today. And actually, this is relevant to what we're talking about, because it's methane hydrate release that actually brings an end to these slush ball events. Okay, because, you know, we have ice ages today that come down to Yosemite, but when you got the sun that faint, you get ice ages that are much, much bigger. And we call them slush ball events. And a slush ball event is where the ice is thousands of feet thick all the way down to about 10 degrees above the equator or below the equator. And we call it a slush ball because even in the equatorial zone, you've got all these floating icebergs. And so the planet gets really cold. Now, it could have become an ice ball. Given how faint the sun was back then, you would expect that you would get an ice ball event. And the problem with an ice ball event is it's permanent. You can't reverse it. So that would be bad news to have the whole planet frozen over. Because you freeze the whole planet over, that affects life. And without life, you're not going to be able to rebound from the slush ball event. But the thing about clathrates, if you've got plate tectonics operating, even in a slush ball event, you're eventually going to generate enough tectonic activity, or tectonic activity will release, one, volcanic gases. And by the way, volcanoes under the ocean release a lot more methane than volcanoes above the ocean. And so subterranean volcanoes are the saving factor that delivers us from these slush ball events. That and the tectonic disturbance of clathrates. Now, where these clathrates exist is places where it's really cold, because you need it to be really cold to actually generate. You either need it to be very cold or high pressure. And so where clathrates exist today are underneath the seafloor and in the Arctic and Antarctic. And yeah, so there is concern about, quote, drilling for oil in the Arctic because you might disturb the clathrates. And if you do that, you're going to release a lot of methane. Methane's a powerful greenhouse gas, and therefore it's going to warm the planet and could be rather catastrophic if you release a lot. And that's one reason why our oil companies are not touching the clathrates. We've not found a safe way to mine clathrates without releasing a whole bunch of unintended methane to the atmosphere. So the trick is, how can we mine those clathrates where we keep the methane and use it as a fuel and don't release any to the atmosphere? And, you know, one of the big global warming scares is, what if we warm the Arctic to such a degree that we melt the permafrost? Well, underneath that permafrost are huge deposits of methyl hydrate. And if we melt the permafrost, then that releases the cap on the methyl hydrates, and all that methane will pump into the atmosphere. Now, the good news is this. Methane doesn't last long in the atmosphere. Because of sunlight, that methane is decomposed, and therefore you only get a pulse lasting, say, for a few centuries if you have a clathrate catastrophe. But of course, that's enough to wipe out all the animals. If you wait long enough, the methane is taken care of. But we can thank God for all these methanogens, because they were pumping so much methane in the atmosphere that, in spite of the fact that methane was being destroyed by sunlight, because these creatures kept pumping more and more methane in the atmosphere, mainly that was kind of the dominant life form on planet Earth at that time. So they were able to keep the methane level at about 70 to 80 times greater than what it is today, in spite of the fact that the methane was being continuously destroyed. That kept the planet actually warmer than it is today. The average temperature of the planet in this region here was about 50 degrees centigrade. You say, what does that translate into Fahrenheit? gee, maybe someone can help me with this, but I think that would work out to be about 130 degrees Fahrenheit. So it'd be unpleasant for us, but hey, if you're a bacterium, you might really enjoy that balmy temperature. So, and some think it might have even gotten as high as 60 degrees, somewhere around 45 to 60 degrees. So actually the planet was quite a bit warmer back then than it is today. Now, that extra warm planet and these methanogens working together with these anoxic photosynthetic life produce what are called black shales. And if you ever go to any place where you've got some really ancient bedrock, you'll see these black shales. Western Australia, South Africa, and Canada, and Greenland are where you can find these black shales. That's where you've got rocks that are 2.5, 3.5 billion years old. And these black shales are produced by abundant methanogens and anoxic photosynthetic life forms, making a chemical transformation in the habitat in which they live. And they produce these black shales. But the amazing thing about the black shales is that they concentrate uranium and thorium. So wherever you got black shale, you've got a uranium-thorium-rich body. Now, it's not so much that if you pick up black shale, it's going to do any harm. I mean, hey, it's a few times greater than what it is in the normal soils around here in California. But when you get a lot of black shale, what you have is surface heat. And it's that surface heat that actually stimulates the plate tectonics and makes the plate tectonics work more effectively. And it's that black shale, when it hits water, especially water at high pressure, that sets up a chemical reaction that produces talc. And it's that talc which allows the plate tectonics to be continuous. You know, without that talc, you would get plate tectonics that would, you know, start and stop. We kind of call it a semi-stagnant lid phenomena, where the planet Earth, for example, would have no plate tectonics literally for hundreds of millions of years. Then you have a sudden jump of plate tectonics, very, very catastrophic. Then you go back into a stagnant lid. But because of this talc production, you actually are able to sustain tectonics at a steady, reasonable level, literally for billions of years. But it won't happen unless you've got these life forms. So without the life, you can't have the tectonics. And without continuous, strong tectonics, you can't recycle enough nutrients to sustain these life forms. So you get what I mean? There's actually a synergistic relationship between the tectonics and the life. They both need one another in order to sustain the tectonics and the life literally for billions of years.
Sounds like design.
Sounds like design, right. You got to have the right life at the right abundance in the right place or it won't work. And then you have to have the planet designed in such a way that you've got the potential for driving this tectonics. I mean, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but there's actually events that have happened before God creates life, events in the solar system that super enrich the interior of the Earth with uranium and thorium and actually set up the Earth where you've got a solid metallic core surrounded by a liquid metallic core where most of the liquid is iron, cobalt, and nickel. What's so wonderful about iron, cobalt, and nickel? They're magnetic. And so that's what sets up the strong magnetic field. And without that strong magnetic field, our atmosphere would be sputtered away by solar particles. Moreover, it's that strong magnetic field that protects advanced light from cosmic and solar radiation. If we didn't have a planet with a strong magnetic field, you wouldn't be able to go outside without a lead suit. And, you know, we were talking a little earlier about these suits that weigh 250 pounds. That's nothing compared to the lead. And by the way, you really don't want to wear a lead suit for very long. Because where does lead come from? Lead comes from the radioactive decay of uranium and thorium. And every time you put a lead suit on, it's got a little bit of uranium and thorium in it. So, I mean, you can wear it in a dentist's office for a few minutes, but I wouldn't count on wearing it for years. Not a good idea. And besides, it's kind of soft, so it flows. It's not a good thing.
All right. Cancer causing agent.
Okay. Let's get to the chemistry lesson. All right. And we're going to really balance this equation, believe it or not. How many of you actually remember balancing chemistry equations? All right, quite a few of you. I mean, that's the challenge of your chemistry teacher in high school. I know a lot of these chemistry teachers, and they say, you know, it actually takes 6 months before the high school students actually figure it out that this is not a hard thing to do. I mean, it's not hard, but it's so different from what we normally do in our high school experience. Yeah, it literally takes the average student 6 months. And I remember talking to my wife about it, and she says, yeah, I was in a fog for 6 months, and all of a sudden it all came together. So, but, okay. If you've got photosynthesis operating, what photosynthesis does is that it takes carbon dioxide and water and makes sugars, starches, and fats. And but that carbon dioxide and water, through the action of methanogens and photosynthesis, is actually going to release oxygen to the environment and methane to the environment. So yeah, every photosynthetic life form takes carbon dioxide and water, turns into sugar, and then the waste product is oxygen. All the oxygen we breathe came from photosynthetic life. There really is no other source of the oxygen in the atmosphere or the oceans. So it's actually a waste product of the photosynthetic reaction. And the waste product of the methanogenic metabolic reactions is methane. So if you've got methanogens, they'll be pumping methane into the atmosphere, and then you've got photosynthetic life, which pumps oxygen into the atmosphere. However, as I mentioned earlier, oxygen in the atmosphere is deadly to methanogenic life. And so what happens when the oxygen is pumped into the atmosphere in the ocean, it begins to kill off the methanogens. And when you kill off the methanogens, what happens? The temperature drops. And when the temperature drops, that impacts the photosynthetic life. Because for about a 50 degree temperature range, from freezing to 50 degrees centigrade, the hotter it gets, the more efficiently the photosynthesis reacts. So planets, you know, for example, you get a lot more photosynthetic production in the tropics than you do in the Arctic. It's related to the temperature. So as you kill off the methanogens, the temperature of the planet drops. When the temperature of the planet drops, that drops the photosynthetic productivity. And when you drop the photosynthetic productivity, the methanogens recover, and they begin to pump more methane in the atmosphere. So up until 2.45 billion years ago, there was this delicate balance between methanogens and photosynthetic life. The photosynthetic life would pump oxygen, that would kill off the methanogens to a little bit, and the temperature would drop, that would impact the photosynthetic life forms, and the methane would come back. So they're basically kept in balance. Kept in balance until some other things happened. Okay, because when sunlight hits the methane, what it does is it breaks the methane and the oxygen. This is the reaction you get. So I think you could all follow that. This equation balances, right? But what happens to the hydrogen? Earth's gravity. Okay, what happens with a helium balloon? It goes up. Hydrogen is lighter than helium. And so this reaction will produce hydrogen, and the hydrogen will dissipate to outer space. Now, the net reaction is this. You've got carbon dioxide and water being put into the atmosphere, and you get carbon dioxide and oxygen. These two balance, so there's no change in that, but you wind up increasing the oxygen in the atmosphere, but you also lose water. And so there's a paper, again, published just months ago that made the point that when life was created here on planet Earth 3.83 billion years ago, that's my word, what they said in the paper was when life appeared on planet Earth 3.83 billion years ago, that set up this reaction. And because methanogens were abundant until 2.45 billion years ago, Earth's oceans had to be a lot more voluminous at the time of the origin of life. At least 10% bigger, and as much as 26% bigger. So yeah, if you look at the planet today, we had a lot more water back 3.8 billion years ago. So it's happening from 3.8 to 2.45 billion years ago. Our oceans are gradually losing more and more water. Now, meanwhile, this synergistic relationship between these methanogens and anoxic photosynthetic life, the black shale production, over time, it's delivering more and more water to the mantle, and it's delivering, stimulating more and more tectonic activity. So the tectonic activity is gradually increasing from 3.8 billion years ago to 2.5 billion years ago. What does that do? It makes continental crust. The net result in terms of the chemistry of plate tectonics is a transformation of basalts. What the tectonics does is sets up a chemical reaction where the basalts are hydrated. So basically the chemistry of plate tectonics, you take these dense basalts, which are kind of the rock material at the bottom of the seafloors. Water reacts with that and makes silicates, and the silicates are lighter. And as this goes on, hundreds of millions of years and hundreds of billions of years, the silicates gradually float up and they form continents. And so 3.8 billion years ago, our planet Earth was a water world. There were no continents, there were no islands. But as this plate tectonics is stimulated by life, the plate tectonics becomes more and more aggressive over time. And eventually you start producing small islands. The first things you see are volcanic islands. Then you actually get what are called cratons, which are tiny continents. And the first ones to appear were in South Africa, what is now South Africa, and Australia. So you have these little tiny continents. And then the water level begins to subside, which means you get more and more silicates exposed to the atmosphere. And as that happens, you get a hastening of all this chemistry. And so with more continents being exposed, these reactions begin to run, and this begins to impact the methanogens. And so eventually you get so much oxygen being pumped into the atmosphere, it starts to impact the methanogens. And as I mentioned, once the oxygen hits a little more than 1/100,000th of where it is today, the methanogens begin to die off. And there's another thing that's happening too. You get a very aggressive period of continental building just before 2.45 billion years. Actually, 2.5 billion years ago, 9% of all the continental volume we have today was produced within a few million years, just previous to this great oxidation event. So it pumps up a lot more continents above the sea. You got this waters going down. And then the other thing that happens is that 2.45 billion years ago, tectonics goes into a lull. They call it the Great Shutdown. It basically stalled for about 250 million years. And what that stall did is it dropped the amount of nickel being recycled from the interior of the Earth to the surface of the Earth by a factor of two. So that now means life on the surface of the Earth and the oceans of the Earth had only half the nickel that they had before. Now, nickel is a crucial component in your diet, but I advise you don't take nickel supplements. Nickel in large quantities, even in tiny quantities, is poisonous to human beings. However, nickel plays a crucial role in these methanogens. There are several enzymes. In order for them to take advantage of their chemistry and expel this methane, they need several enzymes that are critically based on the nickel element. And so when you take the nickel out of the environment, drop it by a factor or two, it has a catastrophic impact on the methanogens. And so when the methanogens get hit, guess what happens? The oxygen goes up in the atmosphere and the temperature drops. Now, one of the benefits of that, it stops the loss of water. If we were to continue losing water, we wouldn't be here today. So it's crucial that you get the methanogens to stop at an appropriate time. Because say if the oceans were to drop by 30% instead of 25%, Well, that would be a real problem for advanced life. In fact, people have argued that if the continents were 31% of the surface of the Earth, we couldn't sustain civilization. In fact, Peter Ward is arguing when it hits 30%. Where is it is right now? 29%. So that tiny of an increase from 29% to 30% would be catastrophic for humans and human civilization. By the way, we are headed there. The continents are getting bigger and bigger. They've always been getting bigger and bigger. But fortunately, over the past billion years, they've been growing at an extremely slow rate. So, for example, it's taken about 250 million years to go from 28% to 29%. Well, we are heading for that 30%. But if we didn't knock off the methanogens at this point, then you could have kissed the possibility of advanced life goodbye. It was crucial that the methanogens be knocked out. However, if I go back here, we still have a sun that's quite faint. So here we are, knocking out the methanogens, dropping the temperature of the Earth, and that causes these massive ice age phenomena. You get three gigantic glaciation events, then follow that with what we call an ice ball or a slush ball event that was almost catastrophic for life on planet Earth. Now, because it was bacterial life, it was able to survive these onslaughts of these huge ice ages on the face of the Earth, followed up by a slush ball event. But here's my point. If it had happened any earlier, it would have brought about a total extermination, permanent extermination of life. This is the earliest time that you can have a big glaciation event. Now, it's also crucial that you start pumping oxygen into the atmosphere. And so what you've got is a creator waiting for exactly the right time to drop down the methanogen abundance, start pumping oxygen into the atmosphere. But the whole point is, look at the physics of the sun, you can't do this any earlier. And if you do it any later, in other words, you could basically keep the planet warm a little bit later, but now you don't have the oxygen pumping in the environment for a fast enough and long enough time that you can get humans on the face of the Earth before the sun gets too bright for human activity. There's really a narrow time window in which all this can happen. Yes?
Yeah, I've always kind of assumed that continents were made primarily from volcanic eruptions. I mean, that's the source of the landmass. But now you're saying that...
It's a tiny source of the landmass.
You're saying the main source is the reaction and formation of silicates, which then get elevated.
Yeah, that's probably responsible for at least 95, if not 98 or 99% of all the continental crustal volume. I might even be conservative, maybe well over 99%. The volcanoes don't do much. It's the subduction and the plate tectonics that's responsible.
They were the first creation, weren't they?
They were the first,
yeah.
Right. So, and that actually factors into this whole event as well, because volcanoes would first form, obviously, under the water, because you've got deep oceans and there's no land mass, and so that's where the first volcanoes are. But geophysicists have noticed a big difference between the subterranean, what they call sub-aerial volcanoes, and those that actually spew their gases above the surface of the water. Namely, that the ones that spew their gases below the surface of the water are much richer in methane than those that are above. And so, as the ocean level drops, that also drops the production of methane from volcanoes and carbon dioxide from volcanoes into the atmosphere. So that also played a role in what's called the Great Oxidation Event. But again, my main point here is the oxidation event has to be at a certain level and the timing is crucial. If you have it happen any earlier or any later, you're not going to get advanced life here on planet Earth. Yes?
You mentioned before that we staved off ice age a little bit, maybe. So I'm thinking if the sun turns off the age increasing, it's probably getting warmer, of course. But how do we have another ice age?
There will come a time when there will be no more ice ages.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that time is not far off. As the sun continues to get brighter and brighter, it'll be the end of ice ages. So, and actually this factors into why you have the Cambrian explosion as late as it does. Because all through this period, you're getting really significant ice age events. They calculate that there is a minimum of five slush ball events. But in addition, there were these really gigantic ice ages. And so you really, from the crater's perspective, you want to wait till the sun gets bright enough where the ice ages are going to be more tepid, kind of like the one we had that came down to Yosemite. Only a couple of thousand feet of ice, no big deal, right? At least compared to the ice ages that preceded it. But that means you're going to want to wait before you bring animals on the face of the earth. Bacteria can handle fairly dramatic ice age events. Larger life forms cannot. So, now, in terms of what the great oxidation event looks like, this is the chart that you see here. Now, in order to make this chart, I couldn't actually put the real numbers on here. What you got here is not a 1% level of oxygen. It's really a 1/100,000th of the oxygen we have in the earth today. So it's extremely low through here. It's not non-existent, because you actually need a little bit of oxygen down here. But then you get what's called this great oxidation event, where the oxygen abundance hits somewhere between 1-3% of the total oxygen on the face of the earth today. And again, this is exaggerated. It didn't come up to 3% oxygen. It came up to, at most, about 1% oxygen. But they call it the great oxidation event because we've got the oxygen abundance in the atmosphere and the ocean going up a minimum of 1,000 times. So in that sense, it's really dramatic for the chemistry of the earth, where you get 1,000 times as much oxygen. Some say as much as 3,000 times as much oxygen as what you had here before. Now, we also notice, this is just coming into the literature right now, something called the Loma Gundy event. What that does, it actually drops the oxygen down quite catastrophically sometime after the peak. The peak was 2.32 billion years ago, but by 2.2 billion years ago, the oxygen content is down. Now, how much was it down? It was down to 1% of what it is today. And so this is the region that they're still researching. It's possible it went up and down a little bit here, but it never got very high. But they do believe that it stayed at least at 1%, which would be an oxygen content of 0.2% by volume in the atmosphere. So that would have been the minimum level, but it never got very high. And then what happens is you get another spike, where it jumps up to 8%, then up to 10%, then up to 21%. So, and this is something too that they're noticing in the literature. You really don't get this jump until 550 million years ago. And when's the Cambrian explosion? 543 million years ago. So the moment that the oxygen content makes possible the existence of animal life, you've got animal life, and you've got animal life in very great diversity. So what does a snowball look like? Kind of like this, where you've got vast sheets of ice, thousands of feet thick, covering virtually the entire planet, where you've got this little region down by the equator, where you've got a little bit of exposed liquid water, but it's filled with giant icebergs. You say, how long did that last? Well, they believe that the great oxidation event, that this lasted for at least 1 million years. So we have an ice age today, lasts 90,000 years. Here we're talking ones that last 1 million years plus. So again, if you're a bacterium, you're going to do okay, at least in this region around here. And then once the ice is gone, you can begin to repopulate. But of course, this would be catastrophic if it happened today. So this is an artist's rendition of what they think it would have looked like on the surface of the earth. Ice literally everywhere. So actually, that's not an artist's rendition. That was a photograph taken at Dome C in Antarctica, where you got this vast, high-altitude plain. But it's just like ice as far as you can see, with really not much in the way of relief. So, but the amazing thing is, that the planet actually recovered from this. And because methanogenic activity had been existing on the Earth for such a long period of time and at such an aggressive level, deep in the crust of the Earth were these huge clathrate deposits, basically frozen methane. And so the tectonics that was ongoing through this period, stimulated by life, eventually would release enough greenhouse gases and volcanic eruptions, and especially methane trapped in these clathrates, that would warm the planet up enough where the ice would melt and life would recover and begin to repopulate the planet. But there was a cycle of this happening over and over again. Now, the great oxidation event, again, this is brand new in the scientific literature, was responsible for laying down many of the minerals that are crucial for civilization. So during this period of time of just a few millions of years, 80% of the mineable manganese was laid down. So is that this great oxidation event where we get the manganese? If we didn't have the great oxidation event, then we wouldn't have manganese that we need to launch and sustain our civilization. It all happened at that one event. Literally 80% of the world's reserves were laid down at the great oxidation event. Yes, and I'll come back to you.
This was a million years, what year did this happen? Like how many years ago?
The great oxidation event was between 2.45 and 2.32 billion years ago. But there was a spike within those, how many millions of years is that, where all the manganese was made. The other thing that takes place in the great oxidation event is the production of a lot of molybdenum, transformation of molybdenum into a form that life can use. They say, what's molybdenum? Well, it's actually a vital nutrient that all animals need. And a lot of bacterial life species also need molybdenum. So what happened after the great oxidation event is all that molybdenum was transformed into a mineral that life can use. Right after the great oxidation event is what they refer to as the bloom explosion, where you get an explosion of life, and literally they say the oceans of the earth was green with photosynthetic life. So there was this huge production, and this began to lay down biodeposits. In fact, a lot of the oil that we're using today actually comes from these ice age events. So thanks to the ice ages, we've got oil, we've got molybdenum, we got manganese, and that's just the beginning of it all. And so we had a planet without ice ages, we wouldn't have that. But hey, we talked about little ice ages last week. These are the really big ice ages. And again, the timing is critical. If it's any earlier, you get a question. I guess it was you. Go ahead.
Yeah, the clathrates, though, are older than, say, two or three ice ages.
Some clathrates are old, some are young. So there's clathrate production going on today, but most of the clathrates that we have in the crust of the earth today are quite ancient.
Yeah, so my question is, at all of these past ice age cycles, if the earth's temperature has gone up to that 3-degree spike and it's dropped off dramatically, but if the 3-degree spike has triggered a massive release of methane, then that would have made that ice age impossible to occur, right?
Well, we're thinking that like the methane that's on the earth today, it's quite safe. Most of the methane is underneath the ocean floor. And so it would take a dramatic tectonic event to release that stuff. You know, it's not temperature sensitive. The stuff that's temperature sensitive is the stuff that's trapped below the permafrost in the Canadian and Alaskan and Siberian Arctic. That's the stuff they're worried about. And they're worried that human activity could release that. Would a 3-degree spike release that? It might release some. We don't know how much. So that may have been a factor. And some have suggested maybe that's what drives it up to that 3 degrees centigrade. So, but as I mentioned last...
Not released, but not so much that it
were... Well, I mean, again, we're still trying to understand how modern ice ages actually work. But there is one model that says, yeah, when the temperature goes up another couple of degrees centigrade, you're going to not only melt the polar ice cap, you're going to be melting large sections of the permafrost, That's going to release some of these methane gases to the atmosphere, which pushes it up even higher to a temperature. But when the temperature gets up that high, you have a very large increase in rainfall precipitation upon Canada, Greenland, and Siberia. And it wouldn't be rainfall because those places are going to be cold. Even with a 3 degree centigrade increase, you're going to be increasing the snowfall. And so if there is a methane class rate release of methane into the atmosphere, it will still produce an ice age in that model. Now, I say in that model because there's still multiple models that are out there. Another model talks about how an ice age is brought about by the disturbance of the Gulf Stream in the Atlantic Ocean. And it could be a combination of the two. And again, as I mentioned last week, these climate models are where weather forecasting models were 100 years ago. A lot of uncertainty. I mean, ask your great-grandparents, what was it like when you listened to the weatherman? Well, it's like, who knows? Okay. Let me flip back here a bit. Yeah, here we go. So this is the part that's still being researched here. By the way, I've also exaggerated the width of this. The width is much narrower, and the height is not nearly as high, but I'm just doing it so you can kind of see what it's like. And it drops down here, and you've got ice age. So this is the start of ice ages. This is the biggest ice age that takes place right here. And then you've got ice ages all the way through here that are far more dramatic than any of the ice ages we had in the 40 million years. And by the way, right before the Cambrian explosion, you got one of the biggest slush ball events. And immediately after that slush ball, you got what's called the Ediacaran, or what's called the Avalon explosion, where you get these animals that show up. The first animals are basically sheet-like, just kind of little smaller. They're jellyfish and sponges and sheet-like creatures, where the creatures don't have a mouth and they don't have an anus. They just kind of absorb nutrients from their environment. And these are creatures that can survive when the oxygen content is around here. But it takes another burst of oxygen into the atmosphere and the oceans in order to make possible creatures like clams and crabs and worms. So they don't show up until the oxygen content hits 10%. That's the minimum level that's necessary for those creatures to exist. But yeah, you've got a giant slush ball event right before this oxygenation takes place. Yes, in the back.
If they're cold-blooded, they don't think it's much oxygen. They came first, that's the idea?
Yes. I mean, for example, we need 20%. We can't handle 10%. But yeah, you know, cold-blooded, small-body creatures living in the oceans, they can survive on 10%, 12% oxygen. They're lizards too, but they need a little more oxygen. So, you know, by the time you get to the dinosaurs, the oxygen in the atmosphere is around 18, 19, 20, 21%. It goes up and down a little bit. And yeah, they're big enough creatures. Anything that's got a really big body mass that needs to move around to collect food is going to need a lot of oxygen. And so even though they were cold-blooded, they still needed considerable oxygen. I mean, crocodiles, for example, need a lot of oxygen. They're cold-blooded, but in order for them to get their food and to maintain their enormous body mass, they need oxygen. I mean, just watch these National Geographic films of crocodiles in the African rivers going after the ungulates. They're very active when they're hunting those ungulates, and they need lots of oxygen to be able to do that. Not as much as we need. Birds need a lot of oxygen. So there's a reason why birds show up as late as they do. Without lots of oxygen, they're not going to make it. In fact, you kind of gave a talk once, Dave, on just how wonderfully designed birds are to even to be able to survive with only 21% oxygen. The other thing, too, is that fires won't burn if you've got an oxygen content that's below about 60% of where we are right now. Now, advanced plants, why do advanced plants show up so late? They need charcoal being regularly distributed to the soil in order to maintain their growth. And so vascular plants don't show up until the oxygen hits over 60% of where it is today. Because if you don't have forest and grass fires burning all the time, you're not going to get a regular delivery of charcoal to the soil. And so that explains why, you know, for the first few hundred million years after the Cambrian explosion, you've got relatively small animals, mostly existing in the oceans. And, you know, the plant life on the continents is non-vascular just because they need charcoal in order to make it. Where do you first see charcoal? Roughly about 350 million years ago. And this is when the oxygen is high enough that you can actually have natural grass and forest fires. Yes?
In one of the classes we took on was, we studied the Permian extinction, which was what, about
251 million years ago.
And that supposedly was methane, maybe, escaping that did that?
Well, yeah.
Pulled off 90% of everything in the world?
Yeah, that's the most catastrophic of all the mass extinction events that we can study in any kind of depth. Now then, during this dotted line era where we're still struggling to come up with data, by the way, they refer to this in the literature as the boring 2 billions, where they say nothing much happens. Well, it's really a misnomer. It's a place where we don't have a lot of data, and that's really why it's boring, because we don't have the data that we got earlier and we got later. But there's actually quite dramatic events happening through there. You're getting these really big ice ages, the temperature is going up, the atmosphere is changing radically. It explains why we don't see any interesting new developments of life in this period. It's just too catastrophic of an era. So it's not boring for the geophysicists. It's only boring for the biologists in terms of what's actually going on in that particular time window. But then you get these, oh, by the way, you don't want to have too much more oxygen. If you have an oxygen content that's about 120% above where we are today, everything burns. And so you wouldn't be able to have forests and grass and crops. You know, you plant your crops, they would immediately burn up. Not a good thing. And by the way, if you have a little more oxygen in the atmosphere, we burn up. In a sense, and by the way, I would suggest don't spend too much time in an oxygen bar. Getting extra oxygen into your system basically overloads the antioxidant mechanisms in your body. And yeah, you'll enjoy life, but for a shorter period of time than the rest of us. So, and I say that because I had a friend of my father when I was growing up was a fighter pilot and the Canadian Air Force. And that was a time when they were giving their fighter pilots pure oxygen when they were flying at high altitudes. And he died before he hit age 50. And so did all of his colleagues. And basically they were dying from oxygen overload. So, but that's what would happen if the atmosphere got a little more oxygenated than it is today. So, again, I would argue this is a design feature. Can you really have a better oxygen abundance than 21%? It's ideal in order for us to live for a few decades at a high level of activity where we got the right amount of natural fires, but not too many natural fires, and where we can actually burn our fossil fuels in order to get energy in a safe way. I mean, if the fires burn more aggressively or less aggressively, it would actually impact our civilization capability. So that's one for all you engineers out there. I mean, in terms of the kind of power plants you want to build, how much oxygen you want in the atmosphere, 21% is right there. Now, is this all an accident? I don't think so. And that's kind of what we're talking about here in Proverbs chapter 3, and also in more detail in Proverbs chapter 8. The whole history of life on planet Earth is planned step by step. The physics of the Earth is planned step by step in terms of the tectonics and the magnetic field, and the chemistry is planned step by step. Only a mind that's able to understand all this physics, chemistry, and biology throughout the past 3.8 billion years is going to know what to have in a planet, and what quantity, at what time, and in what diversity. Okay, let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the privilege of being alive in the 21st century when we're able to read your book of nature in a way we've never been able to read it before. And Lord, as we continue to read and study this nature, we see that everything you've said in Proverbs and Psalms and the book of Job really is showing itself to be a testimony of your abundant handiwork in the record of nature and setting everything up so that we can thrive in this tiny window of time which you've placed us, and not only thrive, but actually fulfill the purpose for which you created us and enjoy our destiny for the rest of eternity. In Jesus' name, amen.